Goebbels pour l'inauguration de l'exposition Yesisement consacrée aux travaux de Big. Big, c'est le nom de l'agence, B comme Bjark, I comme Ingels, G comme groupe, Boop. Cette agence basée à Copenhague fédère environ 80 architectes, designers, constructeurs et chercheurs venant du monde entier. La moyenne d'âge tourne autour de la trentaine. Bjark Ingels a fondé Big en 2005. Ses premiers travaux ont été réalisés en association avec Julien De Smet, architecte belge, au sein de l'agence Plot, créée en 2001. Ils s'étaient rencontrés en travaillant à OMA, Office for Metropolitan Architecture à Rotterdam. Big compte en effet parmi les Colas Kids qui essaiment à travers le monde avec des idées, des projets, des réalisations innovantes, décoiffantes et non moins pertinentes. Pour Big, l'enjeu de l'architecture est de s'enraciner dans les transformations physiques de la société. Bjark Ingels est un créateur incroyablement prolifique. Il a longtemps hésité entre le dessin de comics et l'architecture et on comprend pourquoi. Il choisit de communiquer le projet d'architecture sous la forme d'une BD. L'exposition met en scène cette BD qui rencontre les projets présentés en regard sous forme de maquette qui nous plonge dans un univers inouï. Yesisement est le titre du livre de Big, c'est le titre de l'exposition. Yesisement est un jeu de mots qui résonne avec le lessisement de Mies van der Rohe et aussi le Yes We Can de Barack Obama. Yesisement, c'est le oui aux contraintes et aux contradictions de la commande. C'est la volonté farouche de prendre le risque d'une réponse sans concession à la réalité sociale et politique de notre époque. C'est l'idée du big, ainsi que le dit Bjark Ingels, au sens de l'élargissement de l'esprit, qui est aussi la signification du nom de l'agence. Et pour Arc en rêve, je dirais qu'avec big, Yesisement, c'est toujours oui à plus de plaisir d'architecture. Donc Bjark Ingels va donner sa conférence. Je vous explique le déroulement de la soirée. Il y aura ensuite, au moment de l'ouverture de l'exposition, la dédicace du livre qui est en vente à l'entrée de la galerie au prix de 19,99 €. Ça, c'est des tachènes. Ils sont bons en marketing. Non, mais je précise le prix parce qu'en fait, on a envoyé un mail en disant qu'il valait 15 € et c'est une erreur. Voilà. Donc, vous pourrez acheter le livre et le faire dédicacer par Bjark. Ceux qui sont dans la salle de conférence ont accès à la traduction simultanée dans les accoudoirs de vos fauteuils. Voilà, sur la partie verticale. Vous les trouvez ? La partie verticale de l'accoudoir, pardon. Je ne sais pas si on a testé pour savoir quel numéro, mais enfin c'est le système assez facile. Hein, et je voudrais dire qu'au public, je voudrais dire au public qui est installé sur les mezzanines qu'ils bénéficieront bien sûr de la traduction en français directement. C'est le son qui est envoyé sur les mezzanines, voilà, de telle manière que voilà, au maximum de personnes puissent profiter de cette soirée. Et après l'ouverture de l'exposition qui aura lieu en fonction de la durée de la conférence entre 20h et 20h30, la soirée se prolonge et l'accès à la soirée qui prolonge donc l'inauguration était conditionné à des réservations et à des passes. Voilà, donc ceux qui voulaient rester, j'espère que vous avez vos passes. Il n'y a plus. Enfin, ça va durer un certain temps dans la nuit, voilà. Donc, certains pourront arriver plus tard, certains partir plus tôt. Voilà, donc ce soir, en fait, Big, à vous. Bien.
Merci. Bonsoir. First of all, I'd like to. Say thank you to Francine and Michel Jacques for making this possible. It's a great honor to be showing our work here in Arc en Rêve. And And specifically, I was actually here for the first time 12 years ago for the opening of the Living and Reading exhibition with Kohlhaas exhibiting projects for living and Bruce Mao exhibiting the small, medium, large, extra large and some of his written work about how to communicate ideas. And just in relation to the exhibition downstairs, we were doing a collaboration with Bruce Mao in 2004 for a project called Seven New Denmarks. And we took Bruce Mao for a tour through the office. And he was saying, he was like getting sort of increasingly sort of excited about the various ideas. And in the end, he said, it's interesting that whenever you see architecture, in form of images or publications, it always comes across as dead images and stiff drawings. But when you go to a building with the architect, or if you go to visit his or her office, somehow all the material comes to life, and you hear all the anecdotes and accidents and incidents that sort of created the work, and suddenly everything becomes very exciting. It's just too bad that you can't do that in a book or in an exhibition. So when we were invited to do this this exhibition, we thought it could be interesting to try to see if we could solve the Bruce Mao challenge and try to make an exhibition that would somehow be a bit like visiting an architect in his or her office and trying to, in a way, go behind the scenes to get a look in some of all the sort of different occurrences that actually shape our cities and buildings into what they are. So we tried to ask ourselves if there was a way to tell stories with architecture. And we found out that we didn't have to invent a new format. It already existed in the form of comic books. Because essentially comic books, they use images and drawings and speech bubbles and text boxes to tell stories. So essentially copying the format of an American graphic novel, we told the stories behind the scenes of 30 of our projects, zooming in on the concerns and demands, the conflicts and compromises that actually shape our cities and buildings into what they are. We called the exhibition Yes is More, which is somehow an evolution of some of the ideas of our heroes. Obviously an evolution of Mies van der Rohe's Less is More, this sort of idea that sort of triggered the modernist revolution and liberated architecture from the confines of style or history. Quickly it degenerated into some kind of a minimalistic aesthetic and triggered the postmodern counter-revolution with Robert Venturi saying less is more, why are all modern buildings so boring? Then Philip Johnson came and said, I'm a whore. Let's say unleashing the potential of promiscuity or at least sort of openness to new ideas. 3 months ago I had the honor to visit his glass house estate in New Canaan. When he died 3 years ago, he left 14 different buildings behind, and they all looked like they had been designed by radically different architects. They had actually, in fact, all been designed by him. So, as life evolves, so should architecture. Then we included Barack Obama, sort of saying, yes, we can. He unleashed optimism in a time of global financial crisis. But maybe even more interesting, he was running as a Democratic candidate against the Republican Party at a time where they were more unpopular than ever. And it would have been very tempting and very easy just to do the traditional oppositional politics of saying the opposite of the ruling parties, almost like having a negative agenda by being the opposite of the Republicans. But instead he said, there are no red states of America, there are no blue states of America, there's the United States of America, this idea of unity or even compromise as a radical agenda. And that's exactly what we're trying to sort of illustrate with Yes is More. Sort of this sort of departure from the cliche of the radical architect being this sort of angry young man rebelling against the establishment. that somehow radicality is almost always negatively defined by who or what you are against. So rather than a sort of exclusive attitude, we believe that sort of by incorporating, essentially by saying yes to all the different concerns, you know, like the demands from the neighbors, the limitations of the budget, the political agendas, like the user input, by sort of instead of making it wear your project down, turn it into the driving force of your project. So in a sense, rather than a revolution against something, that architecture could be an evolution driven by input from society. In fact, I think that Charles Darwin is one of the people who best describes our design process in the office. His famous evolutionary tree from The Origin of Species could be a diagram of our design process. Basically, like in the biosphere, all forms, all life forms are born from a process of excess and selection. So like through generations of design meetings, ideas are born. Like at each meeting, there's way too many ideas. Only a few of them manage to survive. So in a typical meeting, we might choose a really beautiful model, and we might choose a really practical model, and we might make them, and they have sort of mutant offspring. Some of them are sort of abortions or misfits, and some of them are really promising, and gradually an idea evolves. A very literal example is a project we did for a hotel and library in downtown Copenhagen, a very big project on a small site. And the design process was almost like a battle for survival. Gradually this idea of a sort of rational tower with hotel that melts together with the surrounding city to form the library, but also expands the public realm onto the base of the building in the form of the Danish steps, a sort of Scandinavian version of the Spanish steps in Rome, public on the outside as well as on the inside. This project was like a public-private partnership between the city of Copenhagen and our client Centerplan. We were so fortunate to win it, but unfortunately Centerplan was financed by Roskilde Bank, the first and only Danish bank to go bankrupt in the financial crisis. So now it's a Dutch investment bank that took over, and I think if we're lucky, we're going to be building it without the tower. But you know, Darwin doesn't only explain how a single idea evolves. Sometimes something happens. There's a spin-off, there's an idea that it might be a great idea, but it doesn't really work for this client or this context, but in another country with another program, it might be the right answer to a completely different question. Therefore, we never throw anything out. We keep all our models. Like our office is almost like this sort of archive of architectural biodiversity, because you never know when a specific model might be actually the right answer to the next question. So basically what I'd like to do now is take you through some of the stories of the exhibition and some of the stories of our work, and show you how ideas evolve and how the DNA of those ideas sort of pass on through the generations into some of the other projects. Starting in China, or even more specifically in Taipei, this sort of idea of urban generosity, that a private program could actually become a generous gesture to the public life of a city, got another chance when we were invited to do a competition for a so-called TED building, a technology, entertainment and design center in downtown Taipei, in this sort of night market full of media shops for like cell phones and computers and cameras. It's a pedestrian neighborhood full of small shops, and the program in the building was almost urban in its diversity. There was like markets, showrooms, galleries, flagship stores, conference facilities, a big auditorium, offices, and a hotel. And our suggestion was like, why don't we sort of expand the pedestrian neighborhood through the site in the form of this sort of meandering street. Each program gets an address on the site. The programs are consolidated into a stack of programs and a wall of rooms. So this sort of combination of rational and slow circulation. the building was almost like an Anish Kapoor sculpture carved out of an urban program. And if you sort of look at the different floor plans, you have like these sort of really rational floor plans where somehow the facade caves in and allows public space to sort of invade the building all the way to this sort of roof that would be sort of an informal arena. So the building is composed of this sort of stack of fiber concrete layers that block out the summer sun but allow the winter sun to penetrate. We proposed a little thermal mass to sort of organically cool and heat the building. And finally for the roof, we proposed this roof garden with a system of evaporative cooling, these sort of mistifiers that would lower the temperature 2 to 4 degrees on the roof. And then because cold air is more heavy than warm air, it would drain naturally through the building and create a cool breeze instead of the traditional air conditioning you have in malls. This sort of outdoor space would actually have a natural cooling. So seen from the sun, the building is like a piece of solid concrete. But seen from the side, it's actually a transparent glass structure. And the facade caves in, inviting people to invade and sort of meander through this sort of inner public space, almost like the Copenhagen Tower turned inside out. So inside you would have like omnipresent daylight but filtered, so you never have like direct sun or glare, and the roof would be the sort of urban arena. So finally we were thinking, since the building is all about media, apart from being transparent, maybe the media could be transmitted to its facade. So we commissioned Realities United, the sort of Berlin-based architect and artist group, and they developed a system where we have LEDs in three colors placed at every half a meter, illuminating the underside of the louvers. But like rather than just like wasting all the energy, like if we illuminate the underside, a third of the power is useful, a third is wasted, and a third is annoying. So Realities United developed this micro texture and inclination that actually concentrates all the effect light outwards. And since it's not only a media wall, it's this sort of hybrid between facade and urban space. When the facade caves in, so does the information, and there's this sort of overspill of information that flows through the public space, almost like sucking people into the building. It was an invited competition, and we were fortunate to win it. So with a little bit of luck, in 3 or 4 years, this could be what a visit to Taipei could look like. I need the sound from the film.
Where do I begin to tell the story of how great a love can be? The sweet love story that is older than the sea. The simple truth about the love he brings to me. Where do I? Where?
So in many ways, like some of the ideas that sort of that died with the financial crisis in Copenhagen in an inverse format became like acquired a new life in Taipei. Maybe just make sure that you keep the sound up from now on. Thanks. Sort of another sort of series of ideas started in with a handful of projects in Copenhagen, beginning with the VM houses, this sort of distorted perimeter block that has been manipulated so that apartments look out over the landscapes instead of into each other. More significantly, the south facade of the VM houses has a characteristic appearance, this sort of landscape of triangular balconies that our client Per Hüfner named the Leonardo DiCaprio balcony, because you have this sort of a ship-like balcony that combines maximum cantilever with minimum shadow. But maybe more interesting, they actually transformed the south facade into a social space that, like, living on the 10th floor might get lonely, but on a warm summer day, you'll actually get to meet sort of all the young ladies in a 10-meter radius around your balcony. So, like, in a small way, expanding public life vertically up through the building. For the two main facades, we were going to have an 80 square meter big wall out of aluminum with a door in it. And we thought, like, this is too depressing to come home to a sheet of metal. Maybe we should do an artwork, maybe something with color or ceramics. And I proposed it to our client, and he said, you know, I'm a developer, I'm not a gallerist. Aluminum is great. But then I had dinner at the top floor of Arne Jacobsen's Hotel Royal in Copenhagen. And I saw this painting, and I asked the waiter, who's this? And he said, it was a portrait of Alberto Co. And Alberto Co is the name of the restaurant, but it was also the name of the director of the hotel when it was being built. And the painter was none other than Arne Jacobsen himself. I really like this idea of the great Danish modernist being almost like a Renaissance man who would sort of design Alberto Co's hotel, then paint his portrait, and then hang it in a restaurant named after him. So I told our clients, Per Hüfner and Axel Frederiksen, that it was like a Danish modern tradition that, since I'm not a painter and since our canvas was so much bigger, we ended up buying 10 different colors of bathroom tiles in 10 by 10 centimeters, put it up in a nice pattern so that from a distance you'll recognize our handsome client, Per Hüfner. And, you know, suddenly there was money in the budget for artwork. I think actually sort of by definition, we turned ass-kissing into an art form. But more importantly, this is the entrance to the kindergarten in the M house. And one morning I was out there, and there was a mom with her kid, and the kid asked her, Mom, who's this? And she said, it's Elvis. So it has really sort of contributed to the spirit of the place. As a side note, in 2006, the VM houses were awarded the best building in Copenhagen. And the award was like a small brass plate, like a golden plate of 10 by 10 centimeters. And with Pierre's permission, we put it in like a gold tooth in his smile. Finally, the VM houses has achieved the highest honor attainable in architecture, I think, which is when you play Monopoly in Denmark. You can actually buy the VM houses. It is the cheapest lot in the entire game, but it's there. So this was like a side note in the story of the VM house, but like later on we got contacted by a hotelier from Stockholm who wanted to do an airport hotel in Stockholm. And the interesting thing is, when you land in Stockholm, where you have the baggage belts, instead of having commercials, you have like photos of people living in Stockholm saying welcome to my town, and the last two people you pass is Queen Silvia and King Carl Gustav, the queen and the king, and it really works. Like you feel welcome to Sweden, and it's a weird typology. Airport hotels, you know, they're located in the middle of nowhere, surrounded by highways on all sides. So we tried to sort of develop a new typology, and in the end we fell in love with this one that we called the hammerhead shark. Essentially, the idea is that normally you arrive by car, park your car in the parking lot, then you go in and have a conference, you look at your car, and then when you go to sleep, you go up in the tower. So you thought, like, why don't we reverse this? You arrive on a ramp, you have this amazing 360-degree view conference center, and when you're finally done, you take the elevator down into your room and go to sleep. So we were pretty convinced about this idea, so we spent all our time and all our budget doing it. Our client hated it. He thought it looked like something designed by Darth Vader. It was like a definite no. He said, like, this has to be a mass market hotel. I want 7,000 square meters of conference on the ground floor and a big slab with 600 rooms. Thank you. And we thought, like, you know, what the... You know, he already designed the building. So we thought, like, what's left for the architects? You know, we could do some facades. Okay, so we thought, okay, let's do some really beautiful facades. So we imagined each room would have a window, a horizontal window, sometimes, you know, floor to ceiling, sometimes, like, narrow, but in general, like, moving up and down. The same room from outside and a bit further away. And as you can see, because we proposed a white concrete facade with the glass, glass looks dark, concrete looks white. So when the windows are small, it gets bright, and when the windows are big, it gets dark. So as you come approaching from the highway several kilometers away, it transforms into a sort of a line raster image of, in this case, Princess Victoria. It's a triangular building, so you have Madeleine, Carl Philip and Victoria, but you have to be like miles away to see it. No, the basic thinking was like, what could be a more beautiful facade than Princess Madeleine, basically. So you can say, like, in the good old days when you had two important streets crossing, you would put a square and you would put a statue of the king. So in this case, you have like three highways merging. When you arrive from the airport to Stockholm, you'll see Victoria, like, sort of, welcome to Sweden. When you drive back from Stockholm to the airport, you'll see Madeleine, because then people might want to come back. And if you have business in Sigtuna, you'll see Carl Philip. But you'll also be able to see him from the airplane. So to our surprise, the client liked it, and the city liked it. And our client actually showed it to King Carl Gustav, and he liked it, although his first comment was like, where am I? So we sort of proceeded with doing the construction documents and the building permits. We discovered that, of course, the choice of color inside the hotel rooms is going to have an impact on the facade, so we did these sort of Andy Warhol variations that sort of reflect out at night. And we just submitted the construction documents for the building permit, and it's kind of surreal to sort of submit serious elevations that look like this, sort of three faces of the royal family. Finally, also, like, it's the most rational hotel in the history of hotels. It's super efficient, but without having almost any architecture, just, you know, the moment where Carl Philip's hair meets the background of Princess Victoria becomes like almost like very expressive and poetic architecture. So that was essentially like, you know, Pierre Hüffner's face that suddenly inflated to become this like prince and princess building in Sweden. Back in Copenhagen and next to the VM houses, we were asked to do a stack of apartments next to a big parking structure. Our client was going to do both buildings, and then he was going to sell the parking structure to the parking company. So we thought, like, since we are doing both anyway, why don't we sort of combine them? Instead of having a stack of apartments looking at a big boring block of parking, all the apartments could become penthouses, sit on a podium of cars. Copenhagen is completely flat, so if you want to have like a nice south-facing slope with a view, you have to do it yourself. So we sort of tilted the housing towards the south. We cut up the volume so we wouldn't steal the view from the neighbors. The cars would occupy all the deep space on the ground facing north for parking, and then in the south sun with the view, all the apartments, but they would be transformed into almost like suburban homes with gardens, each apartment having a garden the same size as the apartment itself. So it turned into this sort of mountain of villas on a bedrock of cars. So all the apartments form the roof of the cars. You have a single diagonal elevator, which is this sort of standard product from Switzerland, because in Switzerland you have a natural need for diagonal elevators. And the parking is transformed into this sort of a, almost like a cathedral of car culture, a public space where you can say traditionally it's this sort of wasted space where especially women might be afraid of parking at night, but here it's really a contribution to the public realm of Copenhagen. From the outside, we wanted to make the parking naturally ventilated, so it needed to be perforated. And we found out that we could, at a 5% premium, we could get holes in 6 different sizes. Seen from a distance, it turns into a rasterized image. And because we always refer to the project as the mountain, we commissioned this giant photo of Mount Everest that is like where it's actually the transparency of the plate that creates the illusion of a photograph. And essentially the entire north facade of the building becomes a 3,500 square meter artwork. When you go back into the mountain, into these sort of colorful galleries, it's almost like traveling into a parallel universe from the colors and the cars and the art. You come into this sort of south-facing urban oasis. The wood floor of the apartments flow outside, becoming the facades. All the rainwater that drops on the mountain is accumulated in a big water tank and recirculated so that in dry periods, we can actually ensure that in a couple of years, the entire mountain will have turned into this sort of Cambodian temple ruin, completely covered in green. Well, basically, the mountain was our first example of what we call sort of architectural alchemy, the idea that you can create, if not gold, then at least sort of added value by mixing traditional ingredients. And beyond, you know, creating terraces for the homes, and somehow we did notice that the parking became almost like an attractive public space. And a year ago, we got, or like a year and a half ago, we got contacted by this Danish documentary filmmaker who showed us this little clip that he had shot out in the mountain. I need sound. So this was like the first few scenes of what would eventually become the documentary My Playground, that sort of documents the impact of human movement on public space by following this gang of traceurs that exercise parkour, this sort of a French contribution to urban mobility in the 20th century. And one thing that was interesting, you can say, like in almost like in a guerrilla way, the traceurs, they expand the public realm in the city beyond the confines of what had been planned into it. You know, you can say quite often the city is dominated by private developments where functions are premeditated and in a way by sort of exercising their bodies, they manage to go where nobody else can go. They conquer territories that are outside normal people's realms. And I saw like a really strong parallel, because you could say like already by combining the housing and the parking in the mountain, the parking had become like a more sort of interesting place to move around. And we thought that maybe this idea could be taken even further when we got invited to do a project for the same developer as the VM and the mountain, a project called the 8th House in this new part of town in Copenhagen, sort of a dense urban neighborhood of perimeter blocks and towers. And we were sort of invited to do a big block, 200 meters long, 100 meters wide. And the big question is like, how do you do such a big project without making it some kind of an anonymous modern monolith? What you normally do in Copenhagen is that you make a lot of identical apartments and then you put on different facades. So it looks like different buildings, but in fact it's one big boring building. And we're not so interested in this sort of cosmetic diversity. We thought like maybe we could actually generate real diversity. For instance, there was 12,000 square meters of offices and shops. Shops like to be close to the customers, so we put them on the ground. Housing goes higher. But since housing is less deep than the offices, we suddenly get extra space where we could have like a small street or even a gardens in front of the apartments. Almost like two-story townhouses with a social life in front of them. Then we add a layer of more classic apartments, and then finally a layer of townhouse row houses, penthouse row houses that have gardens and roof gardens. So we create this almost like a layer cake, a stack of different typologies. The urban master plan says that it needs to be a pedestrian passage going through the block. So we turn it into a figure eight, allowing a shortcut directly through the building. Finally, offices and shops, they like daylight, but they don't like sunshine. So to the south, we push them down. And to the north, we lift them up to become this sort of eight-story office building, lifting all the housing up in the sun and the view. And in reverse, to the southwest corner, we push it down, opening up the entire courtyard for views and daylight. So this sort of distortion of the perimeter block suddenly creates a short circuit, and the sort of the public path, now I have to compete with myself, the public path sort of extends. Please turn the sound on, and please keep it on. Og herfra, hele vejen ned I bunden igen. So essentially we, to prove the point, we had one of our model people turn into this sort of a traceur, showing how the public realm has really expanded beyond the street and up through the building. In real life, this part might be super dangerous, actually. Sugar, sugar. So close and yet so far. So you can say, like, rather than being some kind of an architectural object, the 8th house is more like an urban condition, like a a three-dimensional urban condition where you have various forms of public spaces, various forms of social encounters occurring at all levels. So this was the eight house model, and we managed to start building it before the sort of the onslaught of the global financial crisis. Unfortunately, like almost no of the neighbors got started, so people that move in are gonna have like an amazing 360 degree view. You have like these sort of surreal scenarios. But like this January, for the first time, we were able to take this sort of virgin walk. And as you can see, it's sort of essentially the public and informal space of street life seamlessly expands within the sort of the courtyards of the building, climbs out on the outer facades, and you get this sort of expansion of the sort of spontaneous social encounter that can actually occur at any sort of elevation throughout the eight house, almost like a hybrid between a Mediterranean village and a sort of Copenhagen perimeter block. And the eight house is going to be complete in August this summer. The client hadn't sold any apartments, so they opened the sales last Sunday, and the real estate market is really down. But in 2 weeks they managed to sell 33 apartments. So atmosphere on the construction site is a lot happier right now. As a sort of last chapter in this sort of evolution of the idea of this sort of almost like urban expansion within the buildings and this sort of hybrid between public space, landscape and architecture, was when a minister from Azerbaijan came to Copenhagen and saw the mountain and the eight house and got excited by this idea that you could actually create mountains out of architecture. He told us about Baku, the capital of Azerbaijan, that's overlooking the island of Zira. And it has never been open for development because everybody's afraid that a wall of mediocre towers would ruin the view of the Caspian Sea for the entire capital city. So he suggested, what if we would actually make an urban development that would recreate the silhouettes of the seven most significant peaks of Azerbaijan? That would be sort of the image from the city. So he suggested that we make a master plan for a 1 million square meter urban development on this sort of piece of desert. Clearly a megalomaniac ambition. So we got sort of quite excited. The sound. So we made this little film that sort of explains some of the main ideas of the project. So essentially, Baku is organized like a crescent bay overlooking the island of Zira, almost like the diagram of the Azeri flag. And our sort of goal was to sort of sample the topographies of the seven most significant mountains of Azerbaijan and then translate them into sort of functional, rational structures for human life. The island is a desert. It has no water, it has no infrastructure, it has no nature, it has no energy. So we decided to consider it as a sort of a design of a one big ecosystem where we would sort of deploy all the available natural resources. We would harvest the wind to drive desalination plants that would create fresh water for human use. We would use the thermal properties of water to heat and cool the buildings, eliminating air conditioning. Use the power of the sun to heat the water. And finally, since we didn't have any sewers, we thought that instead of making sewers, we would create these root zone gardens that all the excess from human consumption is filtered through the landscape and actually turning the desert island into this sort of green, lush landscape. You can say normally urban development happens at the expense of nature. Here it really creates the nature. And like ecosystems rather than images of mountains, the buildings actually sort of create shelter from the wind. They accumulate the heat of the sun, and they sort of collect all the rainwater in creeks and lakes. So after 6 months of planning, we presented it to the president, and with his approval, it has now sort of gone forward to become what could be the first carbon neutral island in Central Asia. So essentially, again, this sort of evolution and almost escalation of ideas, starting with the mountain in Copenhagen and turning into the seven peaks of Azerbaijan. Azerbaijan is like indicative of some of our latest developments have occurred in this sort of new development zones in the former Soviet. I have like three last examples. The first one being a competition we did for the new city hall of Tallinn, the capital of Estonia. And Tallinn is this sort of UNESCO World Heritage City. And the main task was that right now the city hall, all the different departments are located in 11 different buildings inside the medieval city. And the suggestions were to make a new consolidated city hall that would bridge the old moat of the city and create a link to the Gulf of Finland. So we started sort of looking at the program, and essentially the city hall doesn't only contain all the public departments, it also contains public service. So if you have anything to do with social security or kindergartens or homes for the elderly, you go to the town hall. And we thought, like, instead of the classic dichotomy of like public space and and public building, that the city hall could hover above the city hall square, and public could really flow underneath the building to meet the public servants. The program consisted of 11 different departments, and Jesus. thank you, Bill Gates. I'm still good. I have a bed going that I can do this in 1 hour and 5 minutes. 11 different departments and a city council. And we thought, like, rather than making a big fat building, we would make it almost like a village of individual departments. Each of them has a size to their own size. They form a continuous floor plate, combining the benefits of a consolidated organization with the diversity of each building being on its own. Daylight seeps deep into the floor plan through these courtyards and gardens. So we called it the public village. So essentially, following the zoning law, we floated all of the buildings to liberate the ground, tilted the roofs to adapt to the Finnish climate or the Estonian climate, tilted the ground to create auditoria and other functions. Daylight penetrates deep into the building and creates views between the people and their public servants. And finally, in one place, the citizens can actually reach the roof and enjoy the UNESCO panorama of the surrounding city. The last thing that in the master plan, there had to be a tower. This is the old city hall of Tallinn, and in Europe, I guess you can't imagine a city hall without a tower on it. So we thought, like, what can we actually place in the tower? Maybe it could be the city council. So we imagined the city council would be this like really generous tall ceiling space with a sloping roof made out of mirror, turning into a periscope so that when the politicians have to make difficult decisions, they look up and they look out over the city that they're messing with. The sort of a political overview. But as a side effect, when the angry citizens gather in front of the city hall, they look in and they can actually see what's going on. If they have powerful vision, they can see the meeting minutes and they can see if one of the politicians is sleeping. So we call the tower the democratic periscope, combining political overview with public insight. And to our luck, the city council liked the idea, and we just signed the contract and started doing the construction documents. We showed this idea to one of our other clients, who's also a former Soviet country, which is the president's office in Kazakhstan. And they said if we would have suggested this in Astana, we would have lost the competition based on that idea, because it's a quite sort of different political climate. But Kazakhstan is an interesting country because it's mostly famous for Borat right now. But in fact, it's the ninth biggest country in the world. The reason it takes so long to fly from France to China is because, like, for 3 or 4 hours, you're flying over Kazakhstan. And until 91, with the collapse of the Soviet Empire, Kazakhstan had never been an independent country, or like an independent nation. So the first thing they did was to move their capital city from Almaty to Astana, and basically creating a capital city from scratch, including all the different institutions that a capital city has. One of them being a new national library. So we were invited to do the competition, and basically most libraries, or like all libraries, are essentially a collection of media, a collection of books, and a lot of spaces for the public to reach them. So all the sort of library archives are organized according to the Dewey Decimal System that goes from 000 to 999. So the ideal diagram is a linear archive, but of course you get a lot of dead ends. So we proposed a perfect circle that would combine linearity with infinity, making this sort of really rational and sort of intuitive structure. Then all the other functions, like reading rooms, would be on the outside with views and daylight. Conference center at the center of the circle. Lobbies on the ground, and sort of research offices and administration on the top. So to combine these four diagrams, we sort of turn it into this sort of meandering loop of public spaces, from lobby to reading rooms to administration to conference center and back down to the lobby. Everything plugged into the storage of books. So essentially you combine the vertical, the horizontal, and the diagonal organization in a single gesture. So on one hand, like very rational and sort of diagrammatic. On the other hand, there's sort of continuous public functions around. And finally, a last program, because Kazakhstan, it's the first time they have a national state, they actually wanted to make a museum telling the story of the creation of the nation of the Kazakhs. So we imagined that it would be wedged, put on top of the library, wedged between the sort of facade that would be wrapped around the building as a continuous rectangle rotating around the diagram of the library that actually creates a Mobius strip, the sort of mathematical form that has the properties that it's a single surface, you can walk on the top, on the inside, on the underside, and come back on the outside as a single movement. So we placed the Mobius library in the middle of this park, creating an archway to enter. And depending on where you see it from, it changes character and sort of silhouette. Of course, when you're building a new capital city, you're very concerned with national identity, and this is importantly the favorite diagram of the president, that the library somehow combines the sort of universal circle with the classic rotunda and the sort of the public gesture of the archway, and finally, almost, if you like, resembles the yurt, the traditional tent of the Kazakhs. But sort of from the outside, you have the gateway to the courtyard from where you enter the library. You have like these like radically different sections from orthogonal to diagonal. And the museum space is occupying this sort of rotating in-between space between library and facade. So this was like a big public competition, partially invited, partially public. And we were competing against like household names like Norman Foster and Zaha Hadid. But to our surprise, we were told that the president actually himself insisted on our design. And we were kind of surprised that the president of Kazakhstan would have such a sophisticated taste in architecture in our minds. But after like a long series of sort of Soviet-style contract negotiations, we went down to Kazakhstan to sign the contract, and we went to the sort of the urban planning office, and we were putting these leather couches, looking up at this big artwork hanging in the lobby, in the form of a giant Mobius strip. And I like to show this as a reminder that as architects, we all always try to deploy the most clever and sort of intelligent, rational arguments to justify our designs. But in the end, it might be a question of what kind of artwork is hanging in the office of the decision makers. Also, they told us that the president had decided to move the library 800 meters closer to the presidential palace, which we took as a good thing. And they asked us if we wanted to see the new site, and we thought, like, yeah, it might be a good idea to see the site. So they took us out there, and this is like sort of 5 minutes after signing the contract. They had already fenced off the new site and started digging a circular hole. So right now we're in this sort of frantic process of actually trying to get drawings to the construction site before stuff happens. The last project that I'd like to show is a project that sort of in many ways deals with this sort of big sort of politically correct question of nowadays, like after COP15 and the collapse of the sort of conference of climate change, everybody somehow has to acquire an attitude towards sustainability, and especially architects, since buildings actually consume 2/3 of the power in the world. We've tried to look at like what role could actually architects play in the sort of pursuit of a sustainable future. I think one of the main challenges is that if you look at the debate from COP15 in Copenhagen, it was all about how much welfare, how much of our great lifestyle are we prepared to sacrifice to pay for being sustainable. The sort of negatively defined question is like, you know, it has to hurt in order to do good. So we thought, like, that's not a very competitive or desirable image of sustainability. Like, we all get this idea that sustainable life is less fun than normal life. So we try to, like, what if we could actually find examples where sustainability actually increases the quality of life? We did this for the competition for the Danish Pavilion for the Shanghai World Exhibition in Shanghai, up with the Matchstick Girl, the Emperor's New Clothes, and the Little Mermaid. So it's almost like a fragment of Danish culture that has been embedded into Chinese culture. The biggest tourist attraction in China is the Great Wall, reportedly visible from outer space. In Denmark, it's the Little Mermaid, hardly visible from the canal tours. And there's like these evident differences, you know, both Shanghai and Copenhagen are port cities, but of completely different scale and quality. But when we look at recent urban development, 30 years ago, this is what the streets of Shanghai looked like, bicycles everywhere. Now we have traffic jams everywhere. The bicycles have actually become forbidden in many places. Meanwhile, in Denmark and Copenhagen, we're expanding our bicycle lanes. We have a system of free bicycles, and 1/3 of all Danes commute by bike. So we thought, why don't we relaunch the bicycle as something cool in China? We sort of remind them, the Chinese, of the bicycle by considering the Danish pavilion as a sort of a piece of Danish street life folded into a loop, so that people can walk or bicycle through the sort of urban space. Like try a Danish city bike and feel how cool it is to ride around in the city instead of sitting in a traffic jam or like searching for a parking spot. So as I mentioned, Copenhagen and Shanghai are port cities, but in Copenhagen our harbor water has become so clean that you can swim in it. One of our first projects was the harbor bath in Copenhagen that sort of expands public life into the water. And again we thought, like, instead of talking about the bicycles, the Chinese should try them. Instead of talking about the water, why don't we actually create a harbor bath in the middle of the pavilion, so that the Chinese can experience how cool it is in the middle of your city to be able to sort of jump into the water and feel how clean, if not how cold, the Danish harbor water is. So at the heart of the pavilion, we created this harbor bath. And sort of in the middle of this little piece of Copenhagen Harbor, surrounded by bikes, we proposed to place the Little Mermaid. Not a copy, but the actual mermaid. Basically have her travel to Shanghai for 6 months, so that the Chinese that actually grew up with the mermaid could actually experience her in real life. In her place, basically for all the Chinese that would go in vain, we invited the Chinese artist Ai Weiwei to create an installation. And his proposal was to mount a security camera in the pavilion looking at the mermaid. It's the same security camera that the Chinese state has installed in front of his house to keep an eye on him. But it's not transmitting to China, it's actually transmitting to Copenhagen, where the mermaid normally sits. For 6 months, Copenhagen and this little piece in Copenhagen is going to turn into a global speakers corner that it's going to be sort of the only uncensored live TV channel transmitting live from China to the rest of the world. And if you go there right now, you might see sort of Chinese political activists talking agitatedly to the mermaid. The pavilion itself, not only does it embody experiences of how a sustainable city could increase the quality of life, like the swimming and the bicycling and the sort of relaxed atmosphere, but also the building itself, we try to resolve a few sort of sustainable challenges. One of the main challenges in a climate like Shanghai is air conditioning. Also, we wanted people to be able to bicycle through the pavilion, so you can't really stop at a turnstile. So we thought, what if the entire building could be naturally ventilated, eliminating all doors and eliminating the energy consumption? The building is actually conceived as a single steel beam, almost like a big ship that carries itself. It has no columns, which means that the facade is part of the load bearing. Because of the spiral shape, as hot air rises, it will be channeled through the pavilion and be propelled outside through perforations. And it's going to take cool air in from the pool and actually creates a natural breeze, almost like what we did in Taipei. In order to do so, we need to perforate the facade. But because the facade is also performing structurally, for instance, when the cantilever takes off, there's an incredible bending moment, which means that in those places we can't really perforate. So you get this sort of varying density and even disappearance of the holes. So from the outside, the architecture is almost like an X-ray of how people move inside the building, but also how the forces of gravity channel through the steel. We also discovered that the holes were perfect for people who wanted an image of the mermaid without queuing. And finally, sort of at night, you have this sort of varied pattern that sort of populates the facades of the building. As a sort of final note, a few months ago there was the opening of the Iron Man 2 movie, and this is one of the first collages we did of the pavilion. And this is an image of Tony Stark's Mad Science Expo in Iron Man 2. And if you compare the two red frames, this is Hollywood and this is Shanghai. And you can see somebody just ripped off our building. And first we thought, this is America, the land of lawyers, we should sue and get rich. But then we thought I think it was Coco Chanel who said that copying is almost like the highest compliment you can get. But I think even more importantly, you can say one of our main ambitions of the pavilion was a way to try to reinvent a more positive attitude towards sustainability. And you can say when Hollywood starts ripping off eco-architecture to show science fiction, It could be a sign that sustainable life is getting more fun than normal life. So in some way, I think sort of mission complete. And to give you a small taste of what it would look like to move around in the pavilion in Shanghai, it's open right now until December. And if Mr. Sound Guy would turn on the volume, I'd like to show you a little clip. And you'll also notice that the pavilion is not only this sort of embodiment of sustainable life, it's also the perfect museum for impatient people. Because you can actually bicycle through the entire exhibition and out again in less than 2 minutes. So I think with those words, I pass the microphone to Black Eyed Peas. To the people from Big, who have been mounting this show. I know how crappy our models are and how little they enjoy traveling to southern France. So a big thank you to Gabi and Freddy and to Kai Uwe for making all this happen. To make the kickoff for the France-Mexico game in 40 minutes.
Est-ce que vous voulez poser deux, trois questions?
Do you mean in your discourse that architecture will gain quality if architects in general will pay much more attention of the trivial parts of the command and will pay much more attention to the cornice of political confrontations, which are inherent in any intervention in the cityscape?
I think I gave you my microphone. I think actually that the life itself is already quite interesting, and even the accumulation of the relatively practical issues of everyday life, like the how to pay the energy bill and how to get from home to work, and like these like practical challenges that all have to occur at the same time. Because in the city, it is this sort of collective coordination of all these little concerns that if you pile them together, they sort of accumulate into like a complex node. And then you don't have to like look into astrology or mysticism or, normally I say French philosophy, but I don't want to say that in this context, to make your work interesting. You can basically just observe the multiple aspects of everyday life and use that as the driving force of your design. And that way you also won't get into the traditional confrontation where a preconceived idea clashes against reality. And I think you have never met an architect that doesn't complain about how the stupid neighbors and the lame clients and the cheap bastards and the imbecile contractors are like watering down their work to the lowest common denominator. That if you actually factor these things in as the departure for your work, it becomes the driving force. It's almost like the sort of Zen idea of in Aikido that you turn the force of your enemy into your own strength. I mean, of course, we also bitch about the clients and the politicians and everybody else, but we really try to make their concerns the flow that feeds the work.
Hello? Okay. Can I press something? Can you hear me like this? So my question is an artistic student question. It's obvious that you embed all these social culture, but it's not working. Okay, so the social culture is very important. It's the main part of your design process. But for all the architecture students, what advice do you have, or what is the source of your motivation to produce such a vital work?
My advice.
What motivation?
Stay out of trouble. I think in general, like, again, I think architecture is this sort of, as an art form, is this sort of occasion to almost like make a snapshot of society. That you can say that in the world, there's like all these invisible immaterial structures. Who has that microphone? All these immaterial structures that flow through society, like cultural structures, social structures, ethnic structures, political structures, economic structures, and they're all invisible to the human eye. But once you you build something, if you stay really alert, instead of like blocking against these forces, you can almost like create the framework around them, and in a way your work becomes not so much the act of like pushing something into life, but more like discovering aspects of life that are already there, they're just invisible. And it can be very difficult to do a project if you don't know why or what it is you're doing. Like if you don't have a mission statement, but as soon as you discover what barrier are you eliminating, what freedom are you conquering, what new possibilities are you laying open, you become like much more powerful and it becomes like much more fun to explore and discover the work rather than pulling it out of your rear end constantly. Like there's nothing worse than having to make tons of design decisions if you have nothing to make them with. Whereas if you almost like outsource the decision making to to these forces from society, all you have to do is assist and you know, render whatever happens. So I think like really this sort of notion that understanding precedes action, spend a little bit of time finding out why you want to do this, and then once you know, it becomes much more fun and powerful to do it. Then always say yes is more.
Alors, je voudrais vous dire. Ah, attendez deux secondes. Juste, je voulais apporter une précision, s'il en était besoin, que le parti pris de la BD, des images de synthèse qui sont utilisées évidemment pour exprimer le concept, le processus d'élaboration et d'évolution de l'idée, peut laisser. Comment dire, peut laisser dans l'ombre la qualité de réalisation et de construction. Et il ne vous a pas échappé sans doute, notamment dans le dernier projet, la difficulté de faire la différence entre l'image du projet, donc à l'état de projet, et la réalisation vraiment réelle qui après a été vue dans le film d'animation. Et il en est de même pour les autres réalisations. Donc une qualité de construction totalement étonnante, et je pense que c'est important de le préciser, de le dire lorsqu'on voit des projets de cette facture-là. Voilà. Alors, et cette transition me permet aussi de rappeler, donc, avant de vous inviter donc, à aller visiter l'exposition, et je vous rappelle que vous pouvez acheter le livre qui va être dédicacé par Biard pendant 20 minutes à peu près, d'inviter, pour ceux qui ne l'ont pas encore visité, à voir, après avoir visité l'Expo PIG, l'exposition Construction de Dominique Lyon. Voilà, et je trouve que ces deux expositions installent un dialogue très intéressant. Il y a également un livre, Construction de Dominique Lyon. Dominique Lyon est également là ce soir. Voilà.